More than 50,000 students in Illinois dealt with homelessness last year. Now, one school district is using a little-known state law to help families find housing, using money from their transportation budget. And if you're a regular NPR listener, you know the voice of Scott Simon, but you may not know he has roots here in Illinois. We'll cover everything from Lincoln to the Chicago Cubs. Plus, we've all told little white lies, but according to new research from the University of Chicago, the whole truth and nothing but the truth might be the best way to go.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
All that and more coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the special encore edition of the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, we'll be revisiting my conversation with NPR Scott Simon from when the 21st went to Washington, D.C. earlier this year. Also, we'll be talking about some University of Chicago research around telling the truth versus lies. As it turns out, people can actually afford to be more honest than we think we can. But first, the State Board of Education says there are more than 50,000 homeless students in Illinois. That means there are tens of thousands of homeless families. And when it comes to providing help, families often shy away from better-known options like shelters. But there's also a little-used state law that allows school districts to provide some relief to help rehouse families that need it. It's one small workaround in the bigger issue of affordable housing. We spoke with Lee Gaines about this back in February. She's reported on this for WILL and the Illinois Newsroom. Hi, Lee. Welcome back to the 21st.
Glad to be here.
Lee, so first of all, I wonder how you found out about this story.
So I actually found out about this story simply by reading the law. I was reading the law about what homeless students in Illinois are entitled to, and I found this section of the law titled Homeless Prevention, and I thought it was really interesting, and I started asking some questions, and I found out that it was a relatively recent law, or part of the law, that was passed in 2017.
That brought you to a Des Plaines resident named Chantel. We're not using her last name to protect her privacy. She works at a department store. She has two daughters. How did she and her family become homeless?
So she also lives with her mother and her two daughters, and they were living in a townhome in Des Plaines for several years, and then the landlord decided to sell the building. And she gave her about a month to find a new place to live, and unfortunately, Chantel was unable to find a place to live because she didn't have a credit score, she said, and also her income level was fairly low. She makes $12 an hour at the department store, and a lot of landlords wanted to see her with an income that was three times the rent that she was going to be paying, and that just wasn't possible for her.
So then what happened?
This happened last summer, so August 1st, she said she was into the hotels. She really did not want to bring her family to a shelter. She felt like that would be unsafe, so she moved her family into a hotel. I think they lived between three different hotels, and that's how the school got involved.
You actually spoke to her, so let's hear a little bit of how her school or her daughter's school found out that they did not have a house.
And I popped my trunk for my daughter to grab something. He saw all of my things in the car, and he spazzed out. He never saw me that way before. He was like, what's going on? You know, talk to me, open up. And at that point, I did the same. I started crying, and he told me to come to his office.
In that clip, she's talking about her daughter's principal, who found out that she was homeless because she was actually bringing her daughter back and forth to school with all of her things in her car because she was never really sure where they were going to stay that night.
How did the school help?
The school ended up using this law, and as far as I'm aware, there are only two families that have so far benefited from this law, Chantel's and another family, and they're both families within the same school district, East Main District 63. So basically what they did was they used some of their transportation funds to provide some temporary rental assistance to Chantel and her family. And she really needed that temporary financial boost in order to get into the house that she now lives in Des Plaines. Another interesting thing about that, though, is even with that grant money from the district, she still had to have her pastor from Evanston vouch for her to the landlord.
That's Lee Gaines with the Illinois Newsroom. We're learning more about the reporting she's been doing on this issue. She mentioned Chantilly School District, East Main 63. I wanted to introduce the associate superintendent of that school district, Sean Schleiser. Associate Superintendent, welcome to the 21st.
I'm glad to be joining you.
We also have Barbara Duffield joining our conversation now. She's on the line from Washington, where she's executive director of the nonprofit Schoolhouse Connection. Thanks for being with us as well, Barbara.
It's my pleasure.
Barbara, as you're listening to Lee outline Chantilly's story, someone who is working but cannot afford housing for her family, having to use savings, whatever she has, to live in a hotel, how familiar is this story to you?
It is all too familiar. The number of children and youth who are experiencing homelessness across the nation is large and growing. And in many circumstances, it is it's a similar situation of having economic challenges and then finding oneself without a home. There's a variation on the story. Sometimes there are additional challenges beyond the housing and economic challenge, mental health, addiction, other issues, and that's another variation that schools confront. And for children, with their education, it can be very, very disruptive, regardless of the cause of their homelessness.
Associate Superintendent, I wonder how you all were able to hear about this. I don't know how you knew about this law and how you were able to use, Lee mentioned, some of the district's transportation budget to help them.
So initially I learned of the law just through communication provided by Regional Office of Education here. Because I was aware of the law, when I became aware of some of the families, I contacted a local homeless liaison and worked with him and a homeless service agency to assist the families in becoming rehoused.
Had this problem ever come up before? Is this something that you all have dealt with before?
Absolutely. This about 1.5 to 2% of our 3,500 preschool through eighth grade students are homeless. It's an ongoing problem. It is something that we deal with on a daily basis, and this law has allowed us to help a few families, and we hope we're able to use the law to help some more.
How much money did it cost to help rehouse Chantilly's family?
Approximately $1,500. And I think one important point is that while it was $1,500, the cost to transport the family to and from hotels for the foreseeable future, say one school year, could, you know, be in excess of $10,000 if they're within, say, 10 miles of the school district. So it's a cost saving to the school district as well as to the state.
Yeah, so the reason that it's a cost savings to the school district is because there's a federal law called the McKinney-Vento Act. And basically what that does is it mandates that schools pay for the transportation of homeless students to their school of origin. So in Chantilly's case and in another family's case, they ended up living outside the district in these hotels, and it was costing, like Dr. Schleiser said, it was costing them quite a bit of money to transport them back and forth to school. I actually spoke with a homeless school liaison or district liaison. His name's Tom Buckler, and he's kind of responsible for this law getting passed in Illinois. And what he told me was doing an informal survey of, you know, about 20 school districts in the northern Chicago suburbs, he found that they were spending about $800,000 collectively transporting homeless kids to and from school. So that inspired him to say, hey, I think that we can actually save money if we instead use that to give them some temporary financial assistance to either keep them in their home or to rehouse them.
Obviously, of course, logically, that's a better solution to the problem. And I wanted to ask you, Lee, just about, we're talking about costs. I wonder what kind of toll for Chantilly, what she said, what kind of costs her family had to endure when she was in this hotel situation.
Yeah, so she was in the hotels for about 2.5 months, and she said, you know, all of her money that she was making at her job was going to pay for the hotel and also the food, because there's no kitchen in a hotel. So they were being forced to eat out all the time. It really wasn't good for her health or her children's health or her mother's health. It took a toll on the mental health of the kids and the family as well. They were all living in a single room together. They had no space. Her youngest daughter couldn't go and play outside. Her oldest daughter couldn't have her friends over. It really took quite a toll on the family.
We actually have some audio of Chantel talking about that. Let's hear a little bit.
Between the three hotels we went to, it was like a enclosed place for my girls. They're used to running around. They're used to being able to play with toys and other things like that. My youngest daughter would always want toys, toys, toys. And the money spent in the hotels, along with buying outside food, it drains you.
That's Chantel, who spoke with Illinois Newsroom reporter Lee Gaines, who's in studio with me here in Urbana. We're also speaking with Barbara Duffield, who's executive director of Schoolhouse Connection, and associate superintendent of the East Main School District, Sean Schleiser. Barbara, can I ask you, just as we're hearing about the costs, we think about the cost of her paying for a hotel, but then that whole idea of the costs of eating out, it sort of seems when you're in a situation like this, the costs probably tend to spiral in a way that most of us who haven't been in this situation haven't thought about.
That's true. And I think, you know, one point that's really important here is that the situation that's being described of staying in the motel and paying for it, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development doesn't actually consider that to be homeless. So a family in that situation with the stress of the children not being able to eat, moving from place to place, staying in motels in that fashion, they're not eligible for homeless assistance from the U.S. Department of Education. And that, I mean, from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, but they are eligible for school support under the McKinney-Vento Act. So that's one large, large challenge, is that some of the housing assistance and priorities for housing are not there for families staying in motels. And as a result, schools see a lot of the challenges, too, because they can't access those funds that are already there for housing for families in these situations.
Associate Superintendent Schleiser, you had a number of how many families in your district perhaps were dealing with the issue of homelessness, but I imagine there's such a stigma attached to this, it's probably hard for families to even know that this help is available.
Yeah, so we do train our school administrators, our secretaries, our teachers, and others on how to spot signs of homelessness so that when they notice that a family may be homeless, we can have a conversation with the family to find out if there are any services we can provide to them.
And I wonder also if we have an idea of what we think a family who is homeless looks like, and probably that idea is wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Usually people think about a homeless family or person on the street corner, and oftentimes a family may be living with another family member or a friend, and that's called doubling up, and they may not even know they're homeless. We have people living in cars and shelters and hotels. Homelessness looks different depending on the person and the family.
Barbara, how common are laws like what Illinois has passed? Is this something that other states across the country are doing to try to help particularly student populations?
There are a few states that have taken some steps at the state level to address the challenges of student homelessness. This particular legislation is unique in the sense that it's about redirecting existing local dollars for education to be used for housing. In other states, for example, in Massachusetts, there's a line item specifically for school districts to pay for the transportation of students who are homeless. So it's extra dollars from the state to school districts to pay for transportation. In the state of Washington, for example, there's extra dollars that are for housing supports, but it's provided to school districts because school districts have that unique position. They know their students, they know what families are going through, and so having school districts administer additional grants in partnership with agencies for housing supports can be very helpful.
And I wanted to ask both of you, it seems obvious that a student needs a home and that helps them be a good student, but I just wanted to ask you all about the role of schools in this situation. Barbara, why do you think it's important that schools are taking part in helping students in this situation?
Schools have a critical role for a number of different reasons, but one of the most important is that education is the best way out of future homelessness. Children who get a high school degree are much less likely to be homeless as adults, And anything we can do to stabilize their education is going to be preventative for future homelessness and for future the experiences of poverty. Schools also are one of the unique institutions because while there may not be housing or shelter for every family who needs it, there is a mandated seat in the classroom for every child experiencing homelessness. So they provide a sense of structure and normalcy and stability that may not otherwise be there. And of course, as we've seen, they're a hub for the community for all sorts of social services, you know, housing and beyond.
And I thought we could just end here hearing a little bit more from Shantil. Here she's telling Lee a little bit more about her current housing and financial situation. As Lee said, this was last summer, and she's now in a stable housing situation.
Like myself, I'm a low-income family, very low-income. I can't really afford the amount of rent that's here, but I work hard enough every day, and I know that at any point, if I fall behind, the school told me that they're here for me. I feel I owe someone something because they did so much for me. So much.
I wonder, Associate Superintendent, how it feels to know that on the one hand, you were able to help someone in your district who obviously really needed the help, but also knowing that there's this much bigger problem here, which is people who are working full time and still not able to afford housing.
Yeah, I mean, to help the families is certainly very gratifying and rewarding. But we also know that there are many, many homeless families who need assistance. It's a significant issue in our society, and I'm just glad that we could provide some assistance to a few families at this point.
That's Sean Schleiser, Associate Superintendent of East Main School District 63 in Des Plaines. I also wanted to thank Barbara Duffield, Executive Director of Schoolhouse Connection in D.C., and Lee Gaines, who brought us this story as she's been reporting for the Illinois Newsroom. All of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support comes from Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Renaissance to Modern Remix, highlights from the European and American art collection, highlighting medieval art, old masters, portraits, and more. More information at kam.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the special Encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're a regular NPR listener, then you know the voice of Scott Simon. He wakes you up on Saturday mornings, perhaps before you've even had your coffee or walked your dog, and he's been doing this for more than 30 years. You may also know that before Scott sat on the mic at NPR in D.C., he was born and raised in Illinois and worked as the NPR bureau chief in Chicago. So back in February, when we spent the week in Washington, there was no way we could leave without extending an invite for him to come on the 21st. We spoke with Scott from NPR headquarters in D.C. Scott Simon, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for asking. It's always good to be back in Illinois. I think, you know, like the way foreign embassies here in Washington, D.C.,
so
a
you're
little
the,
bit of the country.
You're the Illinois.
certainly I am, and I like to think this studio today is a part of Illinois, too.
Scott, I wanted to actually start with a serious question, yeah. Because there's been a lot of talk in Washington about how difficult it is for journalists to cover this administration, but I think people in Illinois have known for years, and journalists have known for years, how difficult it has
yes.
been to cover our governors,
that's part of the job.
Our Chicago mayors, yeah. Chicago's your hometown. I wonder what you think the Washington Press Corps could learn from Chicago journalists.
Well, you know, the thought occurred to me, I guess it was a few weeks ago, I forget the exact date, when apparently a White House functionary took the microphone out of Jim Acosta's hands. I think I can say on pretty good authority that would not have happened in Springfield or Chicago. At least if a functionary of the governor or the mayor of Chicago had tried to take the microphone out of the hands of a working reporter, I think
the other journalists.
The other journalists would have said something. I think there would have been some kind of action. I think they would have said, well, then nobody's asking a question. Thank you very much. I think in both Chicago and Springfield, there's more of a sense of rivalry, but professional congeniality and cooperation at the same time, and an understanding that when you're covering the government, if it's the governor, if it's the mayor of Chicago, professional, and you can even be friendly, but in the end, it is a professional adversarial relationship, and that's just part of the territory on both sides. It doesn't mean you can't be civil, but it does mean that you have to be aggressive.
Mm. I read, Scott, that your mother, who you so lovingly wrote about in your book, Unforgettable, was a Civil War scholar and that she worked at a Lincoln bookstore. Did you grow up knowing a lot about the war and President Lincoln?
Actually, my mother was a chorus girl. She married Ralph Newman, who owned the Abraham Lincoln Bookshop in Chicago, and to a degree became a Lincoln scholar. She used to do a one-woman show as Julia Dent Grant, who was married to Ulysses S. Grant, who happened to be cross-eyed, by the way. And my mother, I can't say she became cross-eyed when she did the one, you know, she would do the show before Civil War roundtables, before civic groups. She would really go all over the state. Being Julia Dent Grant, and she learned an awful lot about the Civil War, Ulysses S. Grant, about the Grant family. She was terrific doing that show where she represented, I think it's fair to say, a kind of overlooked figure in history. And so, but at the time I was growing up, it was before she married Ralph. I was in my late teens when that happened.
Okay, so you didn't know that part of, I wonder what.
I've learned it subsequently. Yes. I certainly hope I've learned it subsequently. I think anybody who lives in Illinois is lucky enough to be imbued with a feeling for Lincoln and great pride and really kind of a provisional relationship in the fact that, you know, your state is forever identified with, I think we can safely say, the greatest of U.S. presidents. And, you know, I have no problem in saying to people, and I like to think since it falls on both Republican and Democratic sides, Illinois has not sent a lot of men or women to the White House, but when we do, it counts for something, doesn't it?
So, as I mentioned, people spend their Saturday mornings with you, and I think that's obviously very different from speaking to a weekday audience. You don't imagine people sitting at their desk or commuting.
No.
They might be in their pajamas or making pancakes.
Oh, they let us know they're in their pajamas or not even in their pajamas, okay. If I'm motivated.
Oh, no.
That way. Yeah,
right. I wonder how that changes.
I try not to think about that part too much.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't think about that part, but does it change how you think about addressing the listener?
Yes and no. Not in the actual moment that I'm doing the show, because I think the fact that even if they are starkers doesn't mean they're not interested in what's going on in the world and the news that's breaking all over the world. But I do think that we really, and some weeks it's a struggle, we want to have the latest breaking news that's up to the minute, and increasingly we have to do that. That's just the demands of the business. But at the same time, I think it's important to have art. I think it's important to have literature. I think it's important to have everything that contributes to a fully rounded human life. And we make a place for that on our show. And sometimes, I mean, the daily shows try to, too, but I think it becomes a bigger proportion of the shows we do. And sports, for that matter. I don't think anybody who listens to our show is surprised to learn that I'm a sports fan.
Particularly. I don't think you'll be surprised to learn that I have some Cubs questions for you later. Yeah, but first, I just wanted to ask you about, do you get a weekend? Or how does this work for you?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm off Sunday and Monday, although I frequently work one way or another on Monday, travel somewhere, report something. I also do stories for CBS Sunday morning, and that typically I have to take off on a Sunday and Monday and do that. But yes, of course I get a weekend. That's important to me. I've got two young children.
So our audiences, I know, love to hear from you, and you do a lot of interviews like this, I imagine. So when we got to NPR, we asked your colleagues what people might not know about you.
Oh, no.
Everyone said, don't worry. Yeah. This is the answer. Everyone said, he's very well-dressed. And I should point out to our radio audience that they do not realize you are wearing, you have a jacket with a pocket square that has red stars. Do you think of yourself as fashionable?
I don't think of myself as fashionable, but I think of myself as a middle-aged man who has no problem looking the part. And as you probably observed from being around here at NPR a few days, a man who wears hard-soled shoes here is considered to be some kind of Beau Brummel. so it's not exactly a high bar to meet. My mother worked, she sold Schmata's on Michigan Avenue for many years at iMagnet at Marshall Field. at Lord & Taylor, and so it was always important. You know, my father was in show business. He was a comedian, and his motto in life was think Yiddish, dress British. And I've tried to do that. I think I wrote in the book Unforgettable, my mother always said to me, imagine if you were clipped by a car and they had to bring you into the emergency room. Do you want to be the guy wearing a jacket and a pocket square, or the guy wearing an Arctic Monkeys suck it and see T-shirt? You know, who do you think is going to get more consideration from the doctors?
And I think you really have your finger on the pulse of NPR fashion with that Arctic Monkeys.
Yeah, you've seen a lot of those T-shirts out there, I'm sure. Yeah.
So another NPR staffer said, yeah, we should ask you about France.
Yeah.
And I gather you have a special relationship to the country. You tweeted last year that you married proudly into a French family.
Yes, my wife is French, from Normandy. Caroline Richard, I married into the Richard family. We were able to spend a few weeks of the year in Normandy. And we refer to ourselves actually as a Chicago-Normandy family. Because both Chicago and Normandy, of course, part of the United States and France, but I think they're both utterly distinct places in both the United States and France. So we're very proud of that. The history in Normandy is extraordinary. Not to mention the seafood. I hate to go on about that, but it's extraordinary. And I'm very proud of the fact that our daughters, who, as you may know, happen to be adopted from China, are bilingual. They are fluent in French. And it was very funny. I think one of the first years in grade school for our oldest daughter, they asked her to fill out a form and asked if there was another language that was spoken at home, and she said yes. And because she was born in China, they assumed it was Chinese. So they put her in a Chinese.
Did they put her in a Chinese language class? Oh no!
And she said, "As a matter, I have no problem in telling you the one word." And we brought them to Mandarin immersion classes for 3 years. But as we say in our family, you can drag the girl to Mandarin class, but you can't make them speak. The one they can sing the carrot harvest song as my wife and I can, but the one word of Mandarin that they really know is pigu, which means derriere. And it is our family, you know, get your pee goo in the shower, get your pee goo ready to go, that sort of thing. And she felt she couldn't really, you know, get much done in a Chinese class when all she could say was pee goo. So she went up to the teacher and explained in English. I think maybe you read the form without really understanding what's at work here.
And do you speak French?
Not very well, not at all. In fact, my wife complains that my French has gotten worse since we got married, and particularly now because our daughters can translate for me. So, no, not very good. I mean, I do what I can. We do try and speak French when we're there.
So I think one of the things your listeners do know about you is that you love the Cubs. And as you wrote in your book about this, it was 2 years ago, I think, that it came out, My Cubs, A Love Story.
Yes.
To be devoted to the Chicago Cubs is to carry a torch of love that defies comparison. So we've got a lot of Cubs fans listening, and of course we've got some Sox and some Cardinals fans listening.
Oh, I'll bet. Yes, you sure do. There certainly are some Cardinal fans there.
Yes.
I'm going to be doing a story, by the way, for CBS on the new announcer for the Chicago White Sox.
Oh.
Jason Benetti.
Yes.
Interesting guy.
And he's been on the 21st a couple of times.
Okay, good.
Yes.
All right, I will mention that to him.
Yeah. So I wonder, do you start every year with fresh hope?
Oh, gosh, yes. I start the year? I don't even have to start the year. It's all year round I have fresh hope. Absolutely.
But
I was hoping they would have been a little more active in the off-season market. I don't know quite how to explain what Theo has in mind. I can't. You know, I have to assume he's got some kind of master strategy, but there's still time after all.
And so I wonder how you adjust your mindset from the Billy Goat curse and all those years and then the World Series and then the past 2 years. I mean, it's like
when you're one of the richest, most successful franchises in baseball, and there's no excuse for you to lose. Yes, I know.
Yes.
It's been a
transition. Thanks for adding that.
It's been a transition. I don't mind making it. I don't mind saying it. I don't mind making it. I think that's what it should have always been. You know, the problem with the Cubs over the years, and let's of course exclude the possibility of a curse because we don't believe in that.
In Billy Goat curses.
Yeah, the curse of the Billy Goat. But there was never any reason for it. It's not like the Cubs were penurious when it came to paying players. Mr. Wrigley was always a very generous owner. The Tribune Corporation, I mean, that wasn't the problem. There were a lot of different factors. And I think day baseball might have been a factor. It might still be a factor every now and then when you get into the dog days of August and now increasingly September. So I don't know how to put my finger on it. But in any event, I think there was a mindset that took hold for many, many years. And thankfully, that has been changed. And I think there's no reason for the Cubs not to be as successful year in and year out as the Boston Red Sox.
But how do you shift from lovable losers to World Series to what the Cubs are now?
I don't find winning any less lovable.
Great.
I think, you know, that's fine with me. I tell you, there is still a quality of Cubdom, and it was underscored for me when they gave out the World Series rings in the months following their victory in the World Series, and they gave them out to all the office personnel as well as the players. And then, of course, you might remember that they gave it out to they gave a ring to, God bless him, the unfortunate man whose name was forever stained in history for, I don't think he really did interfere with Moises Alou making the catch over by the third baseline, but in any event, Stephen Bartman got a ring too. And I thought that said a lot about the character of the Cubs that has continued decade after decade, ownership after ownership, that they would understand that by giving him a ring, it was a way of saying, in a way that no other gesture could, you're a part of this group of people that love our team.
I'm sure you've seen that Cubs chairman Joe Ricketts has been in the news lately.
Yes.
With the revelation of racist emails coming to light. And I wonder if you think it's harder or becoming harder and harder to keep politics separate from being a sports fan.
For some people, obviously. I don't have any problem with the Joe Ricketts part. I have a problem with his emails, which I think are reprehensible. He doesn't have any role in running the team. I think his son, Tom Ricketts, who does run the team, and Laura Ricketts, a very active part-time owner who is a member of Chicago's Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame and is a famous, I think, on the left political activist. He has no role in the team, so I have no problem saying that the children don't have to answer for the infractions and the sins of the father. I have a harder time with them re-signing Addison Russell after charges of domestic abuse. I don't like that at all. I don't think he gets exonerated if he has a good season. I understand Theo Epstein said, look, he's in therapy. We're working with him. We want to give him a chance at redemption. I want to keep my heart open to that. But I had more of a problem with that than any emails sent by Joe Ricketts.
Well, and it's hard, right? Because I feel like this is where sports and society collide. And I couldn't help but think about a story you had in your My Cubs book about President Obama hosting the Cubs when they won the
Yes.
World Series and talking about how he sees a direct line from Jackie Robinson and sports being integrated to his election as our first black president. And I wonder, do you think we don't take seriously enough the way that sports like baseball can influence the rest of our society?
I don't know if we don't take it seriously enough. And I want to be careful about it because I do think, and I say this having written a book about Jackie Robinson, I'm not one for trying to mix politics and national and international affairs with sports. I think they're separate entities, and I think it's rare when a sports story becomes a part of general U.S. history. That, however, absolutely happened with Jackie Robinson.
And you could argue it's happening with the NFL now.
Yes, you could. Absolutely, you could. I think that's between Colin Kaepernick and demonstration. Yes, absolutely. Not to mention I think an important story happens to be the concussion story and the human damage that I think we're beginning to recognize that should have recognized for the past 10 or 15 years that football.
So how do you reconcile that?
You know, I did not watch a lot of football this year. I confess I did watch when the Bears got into the playoffs because, you know, you wake me up in the middle of the night and I'm still a Bears fan. But I don't enjoy the season nearly as much as I used to.
Scott Simon is a Weekend Edition Saturday host. You can hear him this Saturday and every Saturday on this NPR station. Coming up after the break, why do we lie? Well, we tend to think it's for the better, but is it? We revisit our conversation with a University of Chicago researcher about her work. Stay tuned. You're listening to an encore edition of The 21st. Thank you. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to a special encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're talking about how to tell the truth. Well, except for those little white lies. Those are pretty harmless, right? Well, Emma Levine isn't so sure. She's an assistant professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, and her research explores the consequences of honesty in everyday life. And it turns out people can actually afford to be more honest than we think. Back in January, Professor Emma Levine joined us from the University of Chicago campus. Professor Levine, welcome to The 21st.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you've done lots of research about lying and honesty, and you've come to the conclusion that we are not necessarily thinking about lying in the best way. Why is that?
Well, typically when we think about lying and honesty, we're thinking about the lies that we tell to get ahead and undermine others, right? The selfish lies we tell to make ourselves look good and to make others look bad. And it's really clear, if you just ask people, it's really clear that these lies are wrong and have a variety of bad consequences for social relationships. So if we only focus on those, it's not clear how much we're advancing the conversation. And that's important because a lot of the lies that we tell are not these malicious, selfish lies. They're these lies that we're trying to tell to protect and care for other people. And it turns out that our understanding of those lies is really underdeveloped, and it's actually quite nuanced. And so a lot of my research tries to figure out kind of the consequences and basically how we think about these types of lies.
So you said that oftentimes we lie because we're trying to protect other people. I was actually thinking the opposite, that we lie just because it's easier for ourselves. I mean, just it's sort of a lie of either convenience or to avoid confrontation. I feel like that's like the most common what we call a white lie, right?
I think it's both. And I think what makes it complicated is people get these two motives, these two motivations confused. Right? When you tell someone they look great when they don't, I think part of it is a genuine fear of hurting their feelings. And part of it is a genuine discomfort causing potential, right, social distress or awkwardness. And so I think it's often both, which makes it a more complicated dilemma for communicators.
And so here's another little white lie that I think happens. My birthday is in December, and when I've got a gift, even if it's one that I don't like, if someone says, "Do you like it?" I automatically just said yes, because I felt like it would be rude to say no. And that's even if it wasn't true.
Right. And that's why that's a great example that I think highlights the nuance. It's not clear to me, and I certainly have lots of study participants, it's not clear to them that you should be telling the truth and that there's anything wrong with that lie. Especially, for example, if the gift can't be returned, right? What good is telling the truth? There's nothing you can do to change the situation. It would hurt the person's feelings. And so there, right, it might be truly well-intended and have some beneficial social consequences for you to accept the gift graciously. And avoid doing harm.
My guest is Emma Levine. She's an assistant professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, and she studies honesty. And I wonder, Emma, if you can tell us a little bit more about one of your studies that focuses on honesty in everyday life. How do you measure this?
Sure. So one of the studies I've done recently that I'm super excited about is we had people actually go out in their everyday lives and be completely honest for 3 days. So people came to the lab. They knew they were going to do this 3-day communication experiment, but they didn't know what it would involve. And some of them were randomly assigned to be completely honest. So they got strict instructions that you should go out in your life and be honest with everyone around you. And other people were assigned to be kind in all of their communication. And then some people were just given instructions to just go about communicating with others as they normally would. And we have those people in all conditions, and I'm particularly interested in the honesty condition. We have them track their experiences every day and fill out a number of self-reports. So how did this experience make you feel? How did it affect your what we call hedonic well-being? So how pleasant and enjoyable was it? How much meaning did it give you? And how did it affect your social relationships? So people do that every day of the experiment. They also made a forecast before they started the study where they basically guessed. They provided a prediction of how much it would be enjoyable, provide meaning,
to
and
be
cause
honest.
Social connection. Right, exactly. And we find that, you know, through this experience, they mispredict what honesty will be like. It's far more enjoyable and benefits relationships more than they expect.
So people don't think that honesty is beneficial.
No, right? When
it's
you
so funny.
Imagine
the whole
our
control room is shaking their head saying, obviously, honesty is not beneficial. I just had to share that with you. All the producers are going, no.
Right. I mean, imagine showing up and imagine, or just after this conversation, imagine I tell you for the next 3 days, I want you to go and be honest as you can be with everyone around you, right? That gives you this visceral reaction that this is going to be really painful. And I know from my study that fear is misguided. If you were to actually do this, it's not as bad as you think.
And what are some examples of participants in your study who did this and found out it wasn't as bad as they thought?
I mean, it's so far reaching. So, for example, in our study, we had new declarations of love. So some of our participants were college students and, you know, they're holding in their feelings for their significant others and they speak up for the first time. And that, you know, you're so afraid of that. But, you know, sometimes that turns out to be a wonderful experience. On the flip side, we also had at least one person who broke up during the experiment. So you've held in a lot of criticism and resentment, and you speak that, and it ends up in breaking up a relationship. But even then, participants, or at least that participant, ended up thanking us, feeling like, right, if it all I had to do was speak my mind and that resulted in the end of a relationship, it probably should have ended, right? In either direction, the experience was more positive than they expected. Those are the more extreme examples, but other examples just include, you know, voicing workplace conflict or, right, speaking up about something that's been upsetting you or voicing criticism.
And so how did you measure that this honesty was actually positive for people?
Well, we had them fill out predictions before they completed the study and then every day of the study. And so what we're actually measuring is the degree of misprediction. So how much more beneficial is it than they expected? And we find, right, a significant difference such that it makes them happier and benefits their social relationships more than they expect. It's worth noting, though, right, we also had two other experimental conditions that I mentioned earlier. We had kindness and just your normal communication. People don't mispredict the experiences of being kind or just communicating as they normally would. So they're really just mispredicting honesty.
Were you surprised at the result of that?
Yeah, I mean, I was and I wasn't. Once you see the results, it you know, it makes perfect sense that, right, all these fears about honesty, or at least some of these fears, are misguided. I think what was surprising is that, you know, honesty in the end actually didn't look that different from kindness. So yes, we mispredict it. We think it will be worse and more uncomfortable than it is, but the kind of overall effect, how much happiness it brings us, is similar to how much being kind, how much happiness kindness brings us. And so that suggests to me that really, as long as we're kind of focused in our communication, we can have benefits. It just depends, you know, you could focus on either value.
I'm speaking with University of Chicago professor Emma Levine. Emma, I wonder, when we're thinking about this, I couldn't help but think about children. Oftentimes, and I think particularly parents might tell you, they feel like kids might inherently think that being dishonest is just easier, and that's just a natural condition of life.
So I'm not an expert in child psychology, but I am aware of some research on this topic, and I think actually children learn very early on that lying is wrong, right? They're biased towards truth, right? Very young children, they can't tell a lie. They are very, very literal because they're just understanding language. But then between ages about 4 to 7 is when they start to understand that, oh, right, mommy and daddy aren't telling the truth all the time. Sometimes they say they're not home when they are home. then, oh, there is this nuance here. They're telling me to tell grandma and grandpa that I like the gift. And actually, as they age, they develop a more complicated view of honesty, right? They start as really rule-bound and then realize, oh, there are exceptions here.
So you also studied honesty when it comes to healthcare. What were you trying to learn there?
So in that research, we were trying to understand across a couple of different contexts, but I think healthcare is particularly interesting, how communicators and targets, so the targets of information, so patients in the case of healthcare, how they might have different views about honesty, these kind of comforting lies, but also omission, so the omission of information. And what we find there is both communicators and targets. So in healthcare, both doctors and patients recognize and believe that honesty is the most moral communication tactic. So there's no disagreement about that. But there is this interesting disagreement about kind of omission, so not saying anything or not providing prognostic information at all, compared to providing false hope. So doctors often justify omission. They might think it's acceptable to withhold information from a patient, and they think it's more acceptable to omit information than to give a patient false hope. But patients, at least the patients in our studies, actually believe the opposite, that they would rather have false hope than no information at all. Because you could, as you could imagine, as a patient, right, getting no information from your doctor is very anxiety-provoking, and you wonder what's happening. You might imagine the worst-case scenario. And so they actually prefer false hope over no information at all. But doctors who, right, are trained to think about honesty are trying to navigate this in a very complicated way and end up believing that omission might be acceptable.
Emma, what about on a bigger scale? Mm-hmm. So I wonder how this gets reflected in society and societal norms, especially as we're thinking about the way politicians or others are speaking and people are talking about speaking their truth. Do you think that that has changed the way we look at honesty or understand it?
I think it has, and I think it's added this extra layer of complication. So there's a lot of kind of popular rhetoric going on right now about kind of authenticity and radical honesty and being a straight shooter, right? We hear messages like that all the time. And I think that licenses people to say, you know, whatever they want, potentially really offensive and hurtful comments, and write it off as, oh, they were just being honest, or they were, you know, they were just speaking their mind, and they feel like something is moral about that, when in fact they're just hurting other people. Right, which is not how most people judge what is good and bad. And I think it's extra complicated because sometimes, right, the same people who are just speaking the top of their mind and calling that honesty are also telling saying things that are falsifiable, that are untrue, but tend to be what they're thinking. And so I think it adds this complication of, right, how are we supposed to understand what is the truth if people are both saying that, oh, I'm a straight shooter, but also saying things that are untrue.
That's Professor Emma Levine from the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. We've been talking about her research into the consequences of honesty in everyday life. And that's all the time we have for today. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're also on Facebook. If you want to search for the 21st to like our page, it's a good way to comment on what we're working on. You can also post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. We're also available if you're looking for past shows, wherever you get your podcasts, including Spotify. And all those links, though, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us feedback, whether that's a voicemail, send us an email, or remember our social media handles, all you have to do is go to our website, which is 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. We are produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.